Proceed to the second case, XCO International versus Pacific Scientific. Mr. Ramsdale?
Good morning.
My name is Tom Ramsdale. I'm here on behalf of XCO along with my counsel, Carl Myers and Patrick Girdle. To understand why the liquidated damages clause, which is the central issue of this appeal, and whether or not it's enforceable, it is necessary to take a step back and understand what was going on in the real life of this case. And I'll just briefly mention procedurally that when XCO filed its motion, summary judgment on the contract at issue, the trial court did find that there was a valid and enforceable contract and that Pacific Scientific had breached the contract. So that's the historical background, procedural background. In 1991, XCO had certain patents relating to heat-sensitive cable that's used in military and aircraft applications. XCO used that wire, however, to line large oil vessels, refractory-lined vessels like you see by the airport, to detect heat. PacSci wanted the patent rights because it had different applications, so it purchased those patent rights, and for $100,000 licensed them back to XCO so that XCO could use those patent rights on a worldwide basis in its limited field. It was an exclusive license. XCO paid $100,000 for it. Also at the time, the patents in Europe.
When you say for its licensing back, so they could continue to what, insulate these
large oil vessels.
Large oil vessels.
So XCO is in oil, PacSci is in military. At the same time, XCO was seeking patent protection in Europe and faced what's known as an opposition. In the system there, somebody can come in while a patent application is pending and oppose it right there during the issuance stage.
Well, we have that too, right?
Not while it's pending, Your Honor.
Really?
Something that comes afterwards, that's right.
Afterwards?
While it's pending is actually a confidential...
What is the opposite? We do have a procedure in patents called opposition.
You may be thinking of interference practice.
Oh, interference.
Comes later on, yes. Or reexamination. So there was by no means any known fact that XCO was going to get its European patent protection. And under the terms of the agreement, it had to pay because PacSci didn't know whether that European patent was going to issue. When the deal was done, XCO had to continue to pay for that opposition and spent another $100,000 in attorney's fees to get the European patent issued, which it did. So XCO is out $200,000 and now has patent protection in Europe. Fast forward ahead to 1997. XCO is doing business in Europe at a clip of over $500,000 in sales a year. And it learns from its patent counsel that PacSci had stopped paying maintenance fees and that the patents in Europe had lapsed. There was no more patent protection in Europe for XCO. XCO sent the letters of breach. It was not cured and therefore sued ultimately on the liquidated damages clause. This scenario in and of itself shows why this is not a penalty clause. This is not the type of clause that was brought in to punish somebody because they didn't pay money that was owed under a credit application or something like this. This was a real-life situation where when PacSci let the patents lapse, which was the breach, XCO became damaged. The competitive wall that patents creates for you came down.
And you're asking for $600,000?
And we're asking for $600,000.
That's 6 years' worth?
That's correct, Your Honor. It would be $100,000 a year from the breach, which is 97, through the date of the last patent, which happens to be this year. So $600,000. So we know from these facts what actually, this is not penal. This was meant to compensate XCO for a situation that was very complex, that was very unknown in 1991, what might happen later, whether they even get the patent. Now Pacific Scientific has responded, and this is really where the critical error occurred in the court below, with a simple argument, which is, this is on its face an unenforceable penalty clause. And it didn't provide any facts. It simply said it's unenforceable. Now, there's two prongs to this.
So what did Judge Darrow have before him when he held it was was the penalty?
He had the agreement before him. He had argument. He had, there were two different motions, Your Honor. There was the original motion for summary judgment and then a motion to reconsider. What EXCO did, and it did not have the burden to do this, because PACSI has the burden as the party resisting enforcement, but EXCO provided the facts that show the reasonableness of the $100,000, both as relates to the contract itself. That's a critical figure in the contract. It was the amount, for example, that PACSI had to pay each year starting in 95 to 2000, and did pay. It was expected that that amount of roughly $100,000 a year would generate in royalties from PACSI after 2000. And Bud Davis put that in an affidavit. He's the inventor and the officer of EXCO, which was before Judge Dara. And Judge Dara, of course, had the clause. But PACSI's argument is that this is unambiguously a penalty clause. Now, I want to just direct the court's attention to the clause itself and look at that exact argument. But before doing so, remind the court that Frank Zugel, who was PACSI's president, division president, to sign this contract, testified that he wanted this clause included, that he wanted it to go both ways and each side have access to it. So let's keep that as a background and then take a look at the clause. And I would just comment with respect to Zugel that it would be ridiculous for the president of PACSI to agree to a penalty clause that only penalized him and his company in the event of breach. The liquidated damages clause consists of four parts, and it will start with the fact that it's labeled breach and liquidated damages. We know under the Penske trucking case cited in the brief that the fact that it's labeled, although not dispositive, is indicative of the party's agreement to form a liquidated damages clause. Number one. Number two, the clause consists of four paragraphs, 9.1 through 9.4. And what you'll see when we look at these clauses is symmetry between EXCO's relief under the liquidated damages and PACSI's relief in the event EXCO breached. We know if PACSI breaches, the figure is $100,000 per year from the breach through the last of the expired patents. I want to comment there that also shows that it's not penal in nature, or tends to an indicia of not being penal, because if the breach occurs late, so that EXCO is enjoyed patent protection for maybe 10 years, and the breach occurs late in the contract, EXCO would only have maybe $200,000 or 2 years worth of damages, as opposed to a breach occurring very early, where EXCO loses the benefit of its bargain, and therefore it would be greater. That shows flexibility, it shows fairness. But we need to take a look at the clause as a whole, which includes the flip side. If EXCO breached, which is meaning it did not transfer clear title of these patents, it did not sell something free and clear, there was an encumbrance, somehow it didn't provide the know-how, then PACSI has relief. And PACSI's relief, which is in paragraph 9.4, is we don't owe you any money unless there's something past due before the breach. We don't owe you any money from here forward, and we get to keep the patent rights, and you have no claim. So in that scenario, PACSI gets the benefit, and again, $100,000 figure, from 1995 to 2000, for example, the damages were, the amounts owed were $100,000. So if EXCO had breached, then PACSI would have been relieved of the obligation to pay that $100,000. There's symmetry to the liquidated damages clause. It goes both ways, just as Zugel wanted it. If EXCO didn't get patent protection because PACSI let them lapse, EXCO gets money. If PACSI doesn't get the patents that it bargained to buy because EXCO can't transfer them clearly, PACSI is relieved of payment. That is not a penalty clause, Your Honors. That is a liquidated damages clause, well thought out, symmetrical, and fair. Now, what I mentioned is that where I think the critical error occurred was that Judge Dara did not hold PACSI to its burden of proof. That is, PACSI had the burden of coming forth affirmatively with facts to show one of two things, because there's two prongs to these. The first is the amount reasonable? And you can view that either at the time of contracting, was it reasonable at that time, 1991, or you can view it at the time of breach. Is this reasonable in relation to what actually happened in the world? That's the reasonableness prong. And then there is the difficulty to ascertain damages prong, which has to say liquidated damages clause are enforceable when it's difficult to ascertain damages. And, Your Honor, I submit to you that nowhere in the record, in the briefs, or in argument today, you will hear PacSci put forth any facts on any of those issues. They've never argued that $100,000 was unreasonable. They've never argued that it was not difficult to ascertain damages, except by referring to paragraph 1.3, which has to do with failure to pay money, that PacSci failed to pay money. But that's not the issue in the case. In other words, if PacSci had failed to pay the $100,000 a year, then the damages might have been easy to ascertain, because that paragraph says you owe the money, you don't pay it, you're breached. But that's not what happened. This was a lapse situation. So there's no facts before the court. EXCO doesn't have a burden of coming forth with facts, showing reasonableness, or showing difficulty, but it did. And it did it on summary judgment, and it did it on reconsideration. And just to briefly...
They argue, I don't know that this bears particularly, but they do argue that since you were coming into the market with this new product, you weren't really hurt by the lapse of these, by their failure to maintain the patents, because you were selling under a new patent.
Right. The answer to the argument, to that argument, is twofold. The most important is, under the law of this circuit and Illinois law, there's Yaffe versus Ford.
No, I understand.
You don't need to show the actual
right.
damage. Number two is, yeah. I think that argument ignores the importance of intellectual property rights. What does a patent do? It puts up a fence. Now, we know that it puts up a fence around only that which is claimed, right? And if the new cable in Europe is different, then the fence doesn't cover it. But that ignores the reality of what exclusivity means and what it means in a competitive marketplace to have patents on a subject matter. And I think the answer to that is, it may mean, Judge, that EXCO might not have prevailed on an infringement suit in Europe, but the lost exclusivity, Thermocoax coming in the year after the patent lapsed in the record, the lost fence, the door is open and the competition comes in because the patent is gone.
Do you have a patent fight with Thermocoax?
We petitioned Pacific Scientific under the agreement to initiate such a fight, which we took the position they were obligated to do. It did not occur.
Yeah. So in other words, what you're saying is, just because you come up with something, the new bells and whistles, doesn't mean that you shouldn't have some protection on the old,
right?
Because somebody else can use the old that can directly compete with the new.
Exactly. They can come in, take the old, compete with the new. They don't perhaps fear the patent suit so much because the patents are now in the public domain. And that's what happened. And we showed that starting the year after the lapse, EXCO began to lose somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 a year in sales. And now the sales are defunct.
Does that include the new product?
Yes, that is lapse in sales of the new product.
What happened to the new product? Thermocoax? How did you?
We think that Thermocoax is selling to EXCO's former major clients, either major oil companies, in Europe. But I think it's important to remember that what happened is, this gets a little bit beyond the case, but it factually might help. 1997 was a critical year for two reasons. In that year, the patents were allowed to lapse. That's the breach. At the same time, a Canadian company called Conductive Technologies, which had actually been making the old wire pursuant to the agreement, stopped providing it. And in the years preceding 97, PacSci had actually sold the wire to EXCO. From 1993 to 97, it went that way. And PacSci advised EXCO, we can't sell you any more wire. We have some. We need it. We can't sell you any. So what happens is, the inventor, Bud Davis, had to come up with a new wire. And that's what he did. And he came up with better bells and whistles, a better wire. So that therein lies the factual situation. Now, EXCO has presented the evidence on both the reasonableness as of the time of contracting, this $100,000 figure that comes in and out of the contract in many different places. We have presented evidence of reasonableness in relation to the actual damages, that is, this $400,000 to $500,000 a year, and we're only asking for $100,000. There's an issue of reasonableness. And we've discussed today, and the evidence is in the record, of showing the difficulty in ascertaining damages. EXCO is the only party that's going to be here today talking about evidence that it submitted on these issues. The difficulty being the fact that in 91, we didn't even know, EXCO, if it was going to get the patent protection in Europe, and let alone what the market might look like some 7 or 8 years later, and what would happen if the patents were
crossed to breach. The other issue in the case, your claim for sanctions, I think, is dependent on your argument that their counterclaim, in which they're seeking royalties on your new wire, is frivolous.
Right.
And my question about that, I don't think it's a good claim, but on the point of frivolousness, you do have this very broad language in the proprietary rights provision of the licensing agreement. It defines proprietary rights that are being transferred to TaxDye to include inventions and discoveries related to the patents that were transferred. So that's extremely broad. Can't they say that they have at least a colorable argument based on that language that their royalty entitlement covers the new product?
Not that could withstand summary judgment. And the reason is because to be a proprietary right, it still has to relate in any way to a product, and that's a defined term, covered by the patent right. It has to relate to a product which is covered by the patent right. And to be covered by the patent rights, it means that the product must either be embodied in or derived from those patents.
But related is a broader term.
But it has to relate, Your Honor, with all due respect, it has to relate to something.
Sure.
But what it has to relate to is product that's covered.
Well,
and
it relates
the
in the sense
covered.
that your new product is a substitute for the old product.
But it is not covered, but under the definition here, and this is where the critical issue occurs, product has to be covered by the patent rights. And that if you go to the definition then of patent rights, you see it means embodied in and derived from.
No, but related to one of those products.
Yes.
You can have something that's unpatented or unpatentable or separately patented that's related to one of the patented products.
Okay, the further answer to that is that, first of all, what the section we're referring to is section Roman numeral 1B that defines proprietary right. And as we put in our brief, that section was meant to include that we just don't hand you three pieces of paper, the patent, on the day of the closing, but we also provide you with know-how, technical data, and information. It has to relate to a product cover. Now, there is a specific provision in the contract, Judge, for the new cable, and that is section 15, and we mentioned this in our brief. If you go to section 15, which talks about additional...
This is section 15 of the licensing agreement.
Right. And what it says is that the licensor and licensee, section 15, contemplate that the effective and diligent implementation of this agreement may result in the conception and or reduction to practice of additional proprietary subject matter pertinent to the utilization of product, capital P, covered by the patent and related proprietary rights. And then go to section 15D, Your Honor, and it says, in the event that any such additional proprietary subject matter is first conceived and or reduced to practice by or on behalf of licensee, which would be EXCO, during the term of the agreement, then title thereto, shall vest in and remain the exclusive property of licensee. So the parties contemplated that additional invention could happen, that there might be in the future new bells and whistles, and that if that happened, which EXCO did do, it invented and reduced to practice and filed a patent application on the new wire, that title remains in EXCO. This is a specific provision of the contract that would trump the more general provision of related. And I still think that the argument that TaxDye makes is disingenuous in light of the fact that it admitted in summary judgment that to be product, this was an admission in response to undisputed material fact number 10, that to be product, it must be covered by the patent and related proprietary rights. And there simply is no issue in this case that this new cable is not covered by those rights. It is missing claim limitations relating to relating to the insulation material, the resistance range, and the method of manufacture. This situation, I submit, Your Honor, is the one contemplated in Section 15.
They actually argue, don't they? They're still arguing, aren't they, that The new patent infringes the old patents that were licensed to them.
I don't believe there's any argument.
Well, they have this material about claims construction in their brief.
They do mention claims construction
for the first time. Well, maybe, but the implication is that they think that your new product, in fact, the patent is invalid and it belongs to them. So aren't they still making that argument?
I believe they are, which means they're still ignoring Section 15 of the license agreement, and they're ignoring the claims. Because the claims of the old patents, which is what they have the rights to, do not cover the new cable. I did not see an argument, nor would it be germane.
Are they making some argument, mention doctrine of equivalence, but you can have a situation where even though the new patent's claims are not literally covered by the old, the variation is so minor that it can still infringe.
I do not see any infringement type claim or analysis present in PacSci's brief.
I think one of your criticisms of them, one of the bases for your sanctions, was that they were trying to inject patent law into this.
Well, what happened is under U.S. Valve versus Dre, which is a Seventh Circuit opinion, and happens to be from this court, but it's pre-Federal Circuit, and then it went to the Federal Circuit. That's right. Under U.S. Valve versus Dre, the law of the circuit is if in a license agreement type scenario, the patent laws need to be invoked to determine what is covered, then that in fact arises under the patent laws. So this counterclaim, which was alleged that what EXCO was selling is covered product, is exactly what U.S. Valve versus Dre's addressed. And therefore, remembering that PacSci still doesn't recognize that it has the burden of proof on its counterclaim, it claims that EXCO injected this patent defense. It didn't. PacSci injected this patent issue when it sued, saying, you're selling covered product. The judge recognized this. Judge Dara, and this is where his error on 285 really stands out, he recognized the application of patent law to the case and said specifically in his April 25th finding, I find 285 applies. I just don't find this to be an exceptional case. And what he did is find that the patent laws apply, but then didn't follow the patent law cases. And the specific cases I'm referring to are the Eltec case that we cite, which says if you fail to investigate, to test, to compare before filing, that is sanctionable. And the Interspiro case, which is a nice case for this particular argument, because it happened to deal with a license agreement. So you're talking about not a traditional patent infringement case in the Interspiro case, but a license agreement situation as to what's covered, just like this case. And the Federal Circuit found in that circumstance, Section 285 can apply and exceptional cases can be found. I would also refer the court, in looking at all of these sanctions issues, to the many pronouncements of the Federal Circuit, Juden, Antonius, View Engineering. And I want to just comment, and perhaps finish with this comment, that the Federal Circuit was created as a special patent court, a court that has exclusive jurisdiction at the appellate level over these patent matters. And I think that this court should pay substantial deference to the Federal Circuit's proclamations of law on patent issues. Now, if it's not a patent issue, of course, there's no deference. But on a patent issue, like whether or not you're required to test before suing, that is something that the Federal Circuit has spoken on repeatedly and clearly. They refer to the pre-filing comparison of the claims to the accused product as a bare minimum test. And I think that that's very important here. Just to conclude, the question of sanctions is not one of subjective belief. And this is where Judge Dara made, in addition to not applying the patent law that he said applies, is that Judge Dara's test is no test at all. Because he based his finding on subjective belief that given all of these circumstances going on in 2001, it thought its counterclaim was valid. That is not the test. The test is whether or not the claims cover the accused product. A reasonable investigation is taken. And there's a reason for that in patent cases, which is what this counterclaim is. Because everyone who's a plaintiff in a patent infringement case thinks, hopefully in good faith, we've got a Rule 11 problem, they don't, but thinks that the defendant's infringing. But the patent law doesn't say that's good enough. The patent laws say you've got to test. And the reason is because without the test, that is the comparison, there is no good faith test at all. Because everyone would think the other side's infringing, I can go ahead and sue. And that's where Judge Darrow's test, his subjective belief analysis, failed, we believe. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ramsdell. Mr. Savalas?
Good morning. My name is Michael Savalas. I represent the defendant, Pacific Scientific. With respect to some of the arguments that were raised with respect to what was before Judge Darrow on a motion for summary judgment, many of the matters that have been asserted in the appellate brief were not before Judge Darrow at the time he made his decision on the motion for summary judgment. The issue of all of the reasonableness of damages was made in post-judgment motion for reconsideration made by
But you had the burden. What is that? I don't understand, actually. What is unreasonable? I mean, clearly, if you let their patents lapse, that could harm them. New competition comes in. I don't know how that could be estimated when the contract is signed. It seems a classic situation for some, you know, arbitrary number, obviously, but it's at least scaled more or less to the magnitude of the harm because, as Mr. Ramsdell said, the later the breach occurs, the lower the damage total.
But there was no agreement between the parties that paragraph 9.2 would provide that type of relief. There was no agreement in paragraph 2.
I don't know what you're talking about. There's a liquidated damages clause. It's very clear. It has numbers. And you have to, if you think it's a, and on its face it seems reasonable given the nature of the breach that would trigger it. So if you think that somehow it's a penalty, you have to provide evidence or argument or something. So what is your reason to think it's unreasonable?
Because it doesn't reflect an agreement that is.
It's an agreement. Look, it's an amount. It's $100,000, you know, a year. Now, why is that an unreasonable amount? I mean, obviously,
I'm trying to answer the question.
There's an agreement, right? It was adopted by agreement. Now, what is unreasonable about it?
Well, because there was no agreement that this was applied for a failure to pay a maintenance fee on foreign patents.
So now you're defending Judge Darrow on a completely different ground. You're saying there's no agreement. He said there was an agreement, there was a contract, there's a liquidated damages clause, but it's really a penalty clause.
But they're
saying they didn't agree to it.
There has to be an agreement with respect to that it applies in the event of a failure to pay.
Now you lost me completely. It's triggered by a breach. If you don't pay your maintenance fees to the European patent authorities, that's a breach. And here's the sanction for the breach. And the question is this sanction an unreasonable estimate of what the damages of such a breach would be likely to be? That's the penalty.
Well, I'm trying to answer the question, Judge.
Well, you're not answering the question.
Well, I'm trying to explain to you that it was not understood to be a penalty with respect to that because that penalty.
But you understand, you're making a completely different argument from Judge Darrow's ground.
No, I believe those are the arguments that we raised before Judge Darrow with respect to it was unreasonable because it did not specify the nature of the breach it was covered and it provided for the payment of monies and the enforcement of payment of monies. That was the arguments that were advanced before Judge Darrow at the time of the motion for summary judgment.
So, now, but I don't get, because this Section 9.2, I think the language is very clear. It says if the agreement was breached by either party, all amounts then due and owing, exco by PACSI, including such amounts which include overdue, delinquent, or otherwise unpaid amounts under this agreement.
But unpaid amounts.
Unpaid amounts, meaning the un.
What would that mean, Judge Williams?
Right.
Unpaid amounts would not be the failure to pay the foreign maintenance fees. Unpaid amounts would be monies that were due and owing under the installment provisions of the contract. You have to specify what the unpaid amounts would be.
But look, if your breach consisted simply of failing to pay some fee you owe them on time. And they said, well, we not only want the fee, we want the $100,000. Then you could have an argument. That was not proportioned to the type of breach that occurred. But if the breach consists of the failure to pay maintenance fees, that's the sort of breach for which a liquidated damages provision seems entirely appropriate.
Provided, of course, that the parties had agreed in advance at the time of the contract that the amount of damages would be difficult to ascertain as a result of the failure to pay.
No, that's not right. The law doesn't say that they have to sit down. You have to have extrinsic evidence that they sat down and scratched their heads and said, oh, we'll never be able to figure this out. All you do, you look at the clause, and with whatever evidence you want to present as the movement, as arguing that it's invalid, that this is too much.
Well, there was the fact of the testimony that was reduced in deposition of both the plaintiff and his attorney could not recall any conversation to the representative as
but
to
look,
what
you're saying,
what the discussions
which
were on damage.
Which is simply not the law. Is that a liquidated damages clause cannot be upheld unless there's extrinsic evidence that the parties discuss the need for a liquidated damages clause. And that's not how it works.
But you cannot ascertain what is reasonable and unreasonable in a vacuum, and you have to ascertain what were they thinking about it.
No, you don't have to do that. You don't have to have evidence about what people were thinking. That would make liquidated damages clauses presumptively unlawful.
Well, if you don't know what's reasonable, you're asking me about what would be reasonable versus unreasonable. My understanding of the law is that prerequisite language must be in the liquidated damage provision so that there's a basemark for the application of the liquidated damage.
Do you have a case which says that the liquidated damages clause itself has to contain a statement of why damages cannot be left to be determined by a court in the event of a breach?
The decisions of the Illinois Appellate Court, as well as this court, has said that the court conducts a examination of the provision on its face.
But that's not what you're arguing. You're arguing the provision has to contain an explanation of why it wasn't possible to. And where is that in the case law that you have to have this in the clause itself?
I can cite you Lake River Corporation.
My opinion does not say that. Now,
no.
Look, in an ordinary promissory note situation, promissory note says, in the event of default, you pay the face amount plus 15%. And the courts say, well, that's a reasonable estimate of the, cost of collection. But promissory note doesn't recite language about how, we've thought about it, we've scratched our heads, we can't figure out actual damages, therefore we're liquidating them.
Well, I think in this case, this Checkers 8 Limited Partnership, which is a 2001 case that was written by Judge Plum, sets forth the law with respect to what a liquidated damage provision must provide. Because the Illinois case law, substantive law, says the liquidated damage provisions of the penalty are void as contrary to public policy, there's a stringent requirement as to whether or not it's enforceable or not enforceable. Because it's a matter of public policy, the courts will scrutinize it much more closely.
The presumption is the opposite. If it's called a liquidated damages clause, it's presumed to be that and not a penalty. You have to show it's a penalty. Let me ask you a completely different question. Your counterclaim, are you still arguing that the patent on their new product is invalid?
No, Judge, I think somehow.
What is this language in your reply brief about PacSci has not waived its alternative argument regarding claim construction? Claim construction is patent.
Well,
patent validity stuff, right?
Well, no, we were arguing.
Of course it is. The only time the term claim construction is used is when a party to a patent infringement suit is arguing over what is the scope of the patent. do they overlap?
We argue that the current claim was based on a breach of the license agreement.
What does claim construction mean to you?
The interpretation of paragraph 1.B of the license agreement. That's what the interpretation...
That's not a claim. A claim is something in a patent.
No, Judge, I'm sorry if that gave the impression, what the position was argued was that the counterclaim was a breach of contract of the license agreement and the provision of paragraph 1.B.
You mean when you talk about claim construction, you're not talking about claims that appear in patents?
No, we're not talking about the nature of the claim. The counterclaim was not based on a patent infringement case. We weren't talking about that at all. They interjected that in their defense.
Where did you get the term claim construction from you?
Only because we believe it was the interpretation of paragraph 1.5.
It's not a claim.
Well, the counterclaim is what we're talking about. We're not a patent claim. We never argued patent law or patent infringement. We argued that we were entitled to royalties under the license agreement. And in that respect, it's not just the patent applications which control here. We submitted that there were sufficient conduct that were raised, and the court made findings of fact with the conduct as to being held out that the supposedly new cable was related to the old cable, because that's what, in fact, they were selling to our client, not the new cable. And they were holding it out as the old cable and selling it to us and delivering labels attached to it as the old cable. We claimed that we were entitled to royalties under that. And as a result of that, the court made findings of fact that we did not violate any provisions with respect to attorney fees, and we did not engage in any sanctionable conduct under Rule 11, under Section 1927, or under the patent statute. And the court made findings of fact with respect to the claim for sanctions, and in the course of that, made findings of fact as to the conduct of the plaintiff with respect to the holding out and their conduct that we submitted was sufficient to raise a disputed issue of material fact under paragraph 1.B, which was asserted in our response to the motion for summary judgment on our counterclaim. It was asserted at that time. It categorized it as a claim construction, and we were attempting to say we haven't waived any interpretation of paragraph 1.B. Paragraph 1.B, as I think you pointed out, has a very broad definition, and we submitted that the new cable, if it was new cable, was sufficiently related, and in addition to the conduct that they had over that period of time, that would raise a sufficient disputed issue of material fact where we would have a trial on that issue. That the conduct that is set forth by Judge Dara in his ruling and his sanction thing shows that
it would be odd, though, wouldn't it, for them to have agreed to that if they developed new products and patented them, nevertheless, you get to use them?
We don't get to use them. We get paid a commission on the license.
Or you get a royalty on. They develop something new, and you get. And why do you get royalties?
Because we submit to you, Your Honor, that they were really selling the cable, the so-called old cable.
Oh, but this is your patent, and this is your patent. You're saying their product really wasn't entitled to patent protection because it's the same old thing.
That is correct. We never categorized it as patent infringement.
Well, right, it has to be, right? It's the same old thing. They couldn't get a patent on it.
Patentability has nothing to do with it.
How can they get a patent if they're making the same old product, the patent on which is expired? How can they go to the patent office and get a new patent?
Paragraph 1.B states that whether it's patentable or not, we're entitled to royalties.
How can it be patentable if it's just the old product?
I probably cannot. But I
thought that's what you were arguing, that since it's the same old product, that it wasn't patentable.
Whether it's patentable or not would not defeat our claim for royalties.
So you're saying, in other words, you have never invoked or referred to, except maybe in response to them or answer, anything like that, patent law. Law plays no role in your case.
That's what we asserted at the trial level.
Judge Dower misunderstood.
We think so in that respect.
Right.
Now with respect to the other issues that were raised, the motions, the arguments raised with respect to reasonableness that the plaintiff referred to was in their motion for reconsideration, where they submitted additional affidavits of Mr. Davis and Mr. Ertl, and those affidavits were never submitted in the part of their motion for summary judgment. Only as an afterthought, when after Judge Darrow ruled that for the various reasons that he ruled...
What would you think would be a good amount for liquidated damages? Or do you think it would be wholly inappropriate to have a liquidated damages clause? Just for failure to pay maintenance fees.
Judge, you're asking me to speculate. The parties themselves, the representatives who were involved in this, testified they had no no conversations with respect to paragraph 9.
Well, apparently your boss liked this clause.
Well, not quite. He testified in his deposition that he did not recall any conversations with Mr. Davis or Mr. Ertl with respect to the purpose of 9.2, and he speculated, well, I must have wanted it in there only because they had it in there, I had it in there. Mr. Davis and Mr. Ertl testified in their deposition that they recalled no conversations whatsoever with respect to the liquidated damage provision. As a result of that, how can I ascertain what is reasonable or unreasonable if nobody has any reference point as to what the conversation
is? I thought you might have an idea.
Well, the witnesses for the plaintiff said, Mr. Davis said, I don't know who is responsible for putting in paragraphs 9.1 and 9.2.
So they just signed something and just to sign it without looking at it. Because the problem I have, if you look at section 1.53, it says PacSci was responsible for all expenses of any kind relating to the patent and related proprietary rights, except EXCO is responsible for the ongoing European patent litigation. So to me, expenses of any kind relating to the patent and related proprietary rights ties right into 9.2. Where it says you'll cover delinquent and otherwise unpaid amounts.
Judge, what do you...
I don't see why those two aren't tied together.
Well, but there is a reason.
What is that?
The reason is that nobody recalls having any conversations about what is the scope and purpose of 9.2 with respect to failure to pay patent fees. Nobody. Plaintiffs, two witnesses, that Mr. Davis, their chief...
You seem to think that contract interpretation requires extrinsic evidence.
I'm not saying that, Judge. I'm reviewing the law, the case law that I've cited in our...
But no cases say that. No cases say you need extrinsic evidence to interpret a contract.
No, it's not extrinsic evidence, but you need somebody...
Extrinsic. Extrinsic evidence means testimony, documents, and so on, which are not the actual piece of paper itself.
I understand what you're referring to, and I'm trying to say to you...
You're certainly talking about extrinsic evidence when you say they didn't remember why they put the provision.
In the course of discovery, we had to ascertain whether or not there was any conversation.
No, now you're saying you have to have extrinsic evidence to interpret a contract.
No, I think the position that we argue was that on its face, it doesn't have that provision, and therefore you look at the starting point according to Rafael versus Medallion Kitchens, which is a Seventh Circuit case. So you start to look at this from the face of the instrument, and if it's not stated in the instrument itself, therefore it won't pass the stringent requirements of it, and that's what the case law holds in the Illinois appellate courts. As well as this court.
Well, wait a second. Before you talk about this court, I understood you to want us to overrule the Yaki case. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, not overrule it, but not...
What do you mean overrule it? You said it's misguided.
We said it's not applicable today.
Well, you didn't say it was inapplicable. You said it was misguided. Now, if it's misguided, shouldn't we overrule it?
All right. You should overrule it, or you should limit it. Its application is... Subsequent Illinois cases, and subsequent...
Have they criticized Yaki? Have subsequent
no, that they haven't directly criticized Yaki. Well, however, subsequent Illinois cases have not followed Yaki with respect to that. The Illinois cases, starting from Bauer versus Sawyer, have always held that you look at a liquidated damage contract prospectively at the time of making the agreement as to what the parties agreed and understood.
That's the first part of what you said is fine. You evaluate, there's ambiguity in the law, but I think it's fine to say you look at it ex ante. But the second thing you said, which you said earlier, I'm sure you can't cite us a case which actually says the clause itself must contain a recital of why the parties were impractical to leave the determination of damages to the court.
Well, I'll cite Fowler versus Sawyer, which is the Illinois Supreme Court decision, where it states that an agreement made in advance of breach fixing the damages is not enforceable as a contract and does not affect the damages recoverable for the breach unless the amount so fixed is a reasonable forecast.
Exactly, the reason, but it doesn't say it, that the agreement has to have the language explaining why the parties thought it would be reasonable. Most contracts do not contain language that gives the sort of legislative history of the contract. It says, well, we have this provision to do this, and we have another provision because we want to do that.
If you examine, if the case law...
That's true, isn't it? That's contracts aren't characteristically written that way, with a lot of stuff explaining why this provision is there, why that provision is there.
That's true in the context of regular contracts, but...
Where is a case that says that a liquidated damages clause must include the rationale for the clause, the explanation of why the parties wanted a liquidated damages clause?
I've cited them in our brief, but my recollection is Rafael versus Medallion Kitchens. Because the courts engage in an examination on its face of the provision to ascertain whether or not it's a valid liquidated damage or penalty.
Then why are you not calling for a remand then?
Pardon?
Why are you not calling for a remand in your prayer if that's the kind of error or analysis that failed to occur at the trial court?
I'm not appealing Judge Darrow's decision on the summary judgment on the initial complaint because Judge Darrow's decision did not grant their plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. He held that the provision was unenforceable as contrary to the public policy of the state of Illinois and unenforceable. They took the appeal, the plaintiff took the appeal from that. I'm seeking to have that portion of his opinion affirmed for the reasons stated in here. But if I may answer some more of the questions by Judge Posner, the court said that this court, when you do a facial examination, Illinois courts have held that the court can do its sua sponte to see whether or not the provision meets the requirements of Illinois law or whether or not liquidated damage. Because a penalty is not a favored provision, and if the liquidated damage provision is construed to be a penalty on its face, it's unenforceable, and you don't reach the issue of reasonableness. If it's unreasonable, it's unenforceable for several reasons to enforce payment, and this provision specifically provides for monies that are due and owing, that's a payment, and that's what Judge Darrow, one of his rules. And one of the other rulings was that he said that you can't have a liquidated damage provision that covers all breaches in the contract. The law is perfectly clear that the liquidated damage provision must be specific to the specific breach specified in the liquidated damage provision. And this one is not specified as that. So if you have those kind of defects, you don't get past the first hurdle. The first hurdle being, namely, that it has to face an examination to see whether it's valid and enforceable. With respect to the affidavits that were submitted by plaintiffs with respect to this, their affidavits is contradicted by their deposition testimony. Their deposition testimony did not testify to any agreement or conversations with Mr. Sugal with respect to the applicability of paragraph 9.2 applying to failure to pay liquidated damage provisions. Their testimony was they don't recall any conversations with respect to that. They submitted affidavits, post-judgment affidavits, attempting to supply the necessary reasonableness that they attempted to. Now, the first affidavit that was submitted by...
Your position is that should have been at an earlier stage?
That should have been at the time the motion for summary judgment was under consideration. They did it after Judge Darrow ruled on October 2nd, when they submitted additional affidavits. And Judge there, and they said that.
See, that's why I'm concerned about whether there was a full and complete analysis of this at the trial level. Is your position a gotcha position? They just didn't do it in time, and so that's why the summary judgment that you take the position.
I'm sorry.
On these affidavits.
No, they submitted an affidavit. They submitted one affidavit of Davis in support of their motion for summary judgment.
Right.
Judge Barr considered that affidavit, and it's stated in his opinion that he said that there was
the plaintiff alleged that there was a possible infringement by Thermocoax, and there was a decline of sales. Judge Dale did consider that, and he said that that was not sufficient reason to uphold and enforce the liquidated damage provision. As a result of Judge Darrow's decision, they then came back with no affidavits and no assertions to support their motion for summary judgment. Under the well-established law is that this information was available to them in the beginning. They never asserted it. You can't assert it after the judgment.
That's right.
And that's, you know, there's no dispute on that. But in, but again,
but you got the you've got the burdens backwards.
Right.
It's your burden, not their burden. They didn't have to put in any affidavits.
Well, they did. They had an opportunity to respond to the arguments in their reply. They did respond to it in their reply.
But the real response is simply that on its face, it's a reasonable estimation, at least for some sorts of breach. Maybe you're right about if the breach consisted just of failure to pay, maybe it would be unreasonable applied to that kind of breach, since the damages would be obvious, would be what you owed.
But there are, but even the affidavits that were submitted, if you examine the affidavits that were submitted, they don't really set forth with what would be possible damage. They come up with speculations with respect to, well, Thermocoax is competing and we've lost sales. Loss of sales without any nexus.
This is precisely why you need a liquidated damages clause, because it's impossible to prove these things.
If the parties agree to it in the beginning, at the time the contract is formulated, and have that formulated stated with the reasonableness of the amount and why they cannot estimate damages with a reasonable degree of certainty. That provision and that language is not in this paragraph 9.2. To argue now, at this time, when it's not in the brief...
You don't need the language in the contract.
Well, you can't... I'm saying, Judge Posner, with respect to arguing now their symmetry, the arguments were never raised before Judge Darrow about paragraphs 9.3 and 9.4, and they were not asserted with respect to the appellate brief. So you have to have a starting point to ascertain if for purposes of the argument here, if you're going to argue reasonableness, you must have some argument and some understanding of the parties as to what they were talking about. And there is no such, there's nothing
in the record to indicate what the contract, the patents were worth to the parties at the time of contract, Mr. Savell.
The purchase price was $1.2 million.
Right.
A $750,000 cash payment.
Right.
And then there were periodic payments thereafter for the next 5 years. That was the purchase price.
Right. So using that as a baseline, you still feel the $100,000 liquidated damage figure has no reasonable basis?
It's in a vacuum, Judge Baum. It's in a vacuum. That's an argument.
Yeah.
It's asserted as an afterthought to try to cure a defect or deficiency, and it was never raised in the beginning with respect to the motion. Otherwise, maybe you could have dealt with it at the time, but you really couldn't deal with it because if the parties don't discuss it, how can they agree to it, and how do you attack it? And how do you show whether it's a reasonable estimation of damages at the time the contract was made if there was no discussion with respect to what possible damages could arise?
And
it wasn't in the contemplation of the parties.
And so the $100,000 licensing fee versus the $100,000 liquidated damages number, why is that unreasonable?
Because they're unconnected. They're unconnected by any provision in the agreement, and they're unconnected by any testimony. So you have trying to snatch a provision of $100,000 for paying to get a license fee and then try to bootstrap that into an argument saying that's a relationship to the $100,000 liquidated damage. There's no evidence of that. None whatsoever in the contract itself or by the extrinsic evidence at all. Nothing. And that's what they've attempted to do, is to try and supply the missing language for a qualification of a liquidated damage provision by post-judgment affidavits. And those affidavits contradict their deposition testimony. So I don't believe that that's appropriate at this point. The red light's on, so I...
All right. Thank you, Mr. Savell. Mr. Ramsdell?
No time.
Apparently you had no time left. Pardon?
Do I have more time?
No, your time has expired, and so did Mr. Ramsdell. Mr. Ramsdell, I regret that. If there's something absolutely critical to something Mr. Vallis says, it'll clear up something for the court, but only that. You may have a minute to do that.
In 1 minute, I can state that EXCO has cited 8 cases in its briefs that show that a single sum liquidated damages clause, such as in this one it's $100,000, is sufficient. We've cited 7 cases to the court that say that there's no specific language, no.
Did you respond to Checkers in your brief at all?
We did not respond. We did not respond directly to Checkers because it doesn't. It's not on point. What happened with Judge Dara? This is the clarification I wanted to provide. Is that we did submit affidavits relating to the actual damages based upon thermal coax coming in Europe, and therefore argued the $100,000 was reasonable because of what had actually happened. And where Judge Dara errs is saying, yes, well, that could be true, but I can't look at that time frame. I can't view reasonableness from the time of breach. And that's exactly what Yaki says you can do, and that's what happened there. And that explains this issue. I'm going to finish by saying that the defense of these counterclaims cost EXCO in excess of $400,000. And
well, Mr. Civella said that nowhere in the counterclaims or in his arguments or briefs or anywhere, except maybe this accidental reference to claim construction in his reply brief, did his client try to invoke patent law. Is that correct?
I didn't understand, frankly, Judge, some of PacSci's arguments on its brief. I certainly thought that by their final brief they were attempting at some level to perform the traditional patent claims construction that says, here are the claims, and now we have to look at the accused device and
what
see
what about in the district court?
Well, we certainly did that. There was no argument at all from PacSci.
But did they have a patent? Didn't they have a patent lawyer who said
yes, but his analysis never attempted to compare.
No, but my question is, you said that their counterclaim relied on patent law. And Mr. Stiavelis was very emphatic that nowhere did they ever try to invoke patent law. And so my question is whether you agree with his statement.
I do not. I respectfully submit he does not understand the nature of the claims that he raised. They certainly do under U.S. Valves versus Drake. No question about it. The issue is, if the resolution of the question is whether or not an accused product falls within a scope of a claim, that's what they're saying. You're selling a product covered by the license agreement. The license agreement defines products as that which is covered by the claim. You've got to look at the claim, just like U.S. Valves, and determine whether or not this product falls within it. And when that happens, that is a patent law issue. That's what U.S. Valves stands for. Now, what I wanted to finish is to say that this case was an extremely expensive case to litigate because of some of the issues that we're seeing here today. The absolute refusal to follow U.S. Valves, to consider the application of patent law, to litigate the counterclaim in a manner that was reasonable. This was the definition of vexatious and harassing litigation. It was expensive. It cost EXCO almost $400,000 by now, and I'm sure after the appeal it will be more than that. At the same time, they proceeded on this liquidated damages clause, arguing law without law, had the wrong burden of proof. They made arguments about language that's necessary that clearly is not in the cases. And I guess that I wanted to conclude by saying I think we've seen today why this case was unnecessarily protracted, why there were meritless defenses and arguments raised, and why sanctions are required and proper under Rule 11, Section 1927, Section 285. We will pray for the remand and relief sought on the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsdell. Thanks to all counsel. Okay.